Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, go to the events page. Hate to break it to you, but other than getting on a wait list, which I think you can do, the Here We Still Stand Conference for next year, which is a full year away, really. It's like 50 weeks away, is... It's sold out in record time, sold out in like 36 hours. So if you were wanting to do that, you can get on that wait list. And I would recommend you do get on the wait list if you are wanting to go, because people do have things come up and then tickets become available, so you can do that. But also, if you're like, oh no, I really wanted to go conferencing this year, well, there are still some, not a lot, but a few tickets to Northwest Arkansas that will also sell out. So you can get tickets to that. That's the first weekend in May. And there's a link in the show notes, or you can go over to the events page and scroll down, find the regional event, come hang out with us there. But I recommend you do that rather quickly as well. Chad, we're back. We just got back from Here We Still Stand. So that was a lot of fun. Did record a live episode, which by the time you hear this episode, you will have listened to that. On Psalm 23. It was a good time, but it's you know, it's always good to be home.
Yeah, good to be back in my own bed, back in Texas. But it was a fantastic time. I mean, you can't go wrong with Lewis, right?
Can't go wrong.
A lot of great presentations, great fun, great hanging out with folks. So I'm already looking forward to next year.
Yeah, man. And if you were wondering, like, oh man, what is that like? Well, all those talks will be edited and released as videos in a couple weeks. All right. Well, we are in Job chapter 4, and we ended last time we were with Job finally saying some words. You know, he had some buddies come and sit around with him for a while, and 7 days, man, a full week, nobody says nothing. You know, it's just silence. And then Job opens his mouth and lets it rip, and he starts talking about, cursed be the day that I was born, and why do I gotta be alive when there's so many people that are dying that would like to be alive, and here I am alive and wanting to die, and I can't. And man, every single person that's ever died has it better than me. I mean, the thieves have it better than me. The kings have it better than me. The murderers have it better than me. Everyone, good or bad, if they're dead, they're better off than I am. And that's the sort of stuff he's uttering. And today we get into one of his friends is going to have a sort of response to what Job has to said.
Yeah, I love his opening remark too. It's a question. He's like, you can understand Job has just said all of these pretty heart-wrenching words. And so the opening comment from Eliphaz is, so if one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? He's like, I guess I'm the first one who's going to kind of step out here and talk to you, Job. Just want to know what kind of reception I'm going to get here. Are you going to, you know, are you going to let me speak and come right back at me? What kind of conversation are we going to have here between me and you? So it's a 2-chapter response. Of course, that's just kind of an artificial dividing mark between these two. This whole speech, but yeah, they got to divide it up somehow. So we have chapter 4 and 5 is Eliphaz, the, what'd you call him before we started recording?
The termite.
Yeah. He's gonna eat through the foundation of a Job's house here. So he's the Temanite, which is probably a reference to, somewhere in the region of Edom. So south of Israel, south of the Dead Sea. But anyway, that's his name, Eliphaz Temanite. We've already been introduced to him, as well as the other two so-called friends. So this is the opening response, if you can call it a response. I mean, I think I mentioned in the last episode, don't think of these as like a courtroom drama, where, okay, the prosecution stands up, and the defense stands up in response to that, and the prosecution responds to the defense. This is not your typical debate where each person responds to the other person. Don't be looking for anything like that. I mean, there is some kind of back and forth. You can tell one is in some way reacting to what has been said before. but it's not a kind of a tit for tat kind of response. Think of this as just basically these guys standing up and delivering speeches on what they're thinking about, you know, everything that's been said, as well as everything that's been going on, and they're trying to make their rhetorical points when they give these speeches. So, it starts out here with a couple of questions. And we don't know, keep this in mind too, this is always a challenge for interpretation and for biblical reading in general. You can't hear this being said. So, is this said gently? Is this said forcefully? In a few minutes, we'll come across a verse, and you don't know, is this said kind of mockingly, sarcastically, angrily, forcefully, or hesitantly? You never know, in other words, what tone of voice to use when you're reading some of this. So that's even the way we read, the tone we use when we read some of this is interpretation. So anyway, I'll jump in, and I guess I'll read the first six verses. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "If one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you," of course he's talking here to Job, "behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees." Well, he's doing pretty good so far. You know, it's kind of very complimentary of Job. Now we have a little transition, verse 5. But, there's always a but. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? So, I mean, he starts out, in my opinion, good. Of course, they were silent 7 days and seven nights, and that was even more rhetorically beautiful than anything they're going to say. Their silence was good. They were just sitting with Job, suffering with him. Compassionate, silent suffering. So now he says, who can keep from speaking? In other words, hey, we've been silent a long time. You've just let out this whole string of complaints and curses and whatnot. So I got to say something here. And he starts out complimentary. And that's one thing I want to try and do with these three friends is, you know, when they say something good, that's great. Point that out. When they said something true, well, good, point that out too. But what we're going to see here, and we're already going to pick up on this, I mean, really fast in his speech, is there sometimes when they say something that is true, in fact, that might even be biblical, like you can find a parallel to it elsewhere in the Bible. We're going to see a lot of examples of that in these first couple of chapters from Eliphaz. But they're wrong in applying it to Job's situation. So you can take something true from the Bible and apply it to a person, and depending on that person's situation, it might be a true application or a false application of those words.
Yeah, I mean, well, so he starts by saying, hey, you've instructed a lot of people, and you've strengthened many weak hands. You've upheld people when they were stumbling. You've made firm, feeble knees. This all sounds like, to me, that he's saying, you've seen people suffer, and you've been there for them. Like you've seen people go through difficult things, and you've helped them. You've given them sound words, whatever it is. You know, you've lifted them up. So you should know that this sort of thing happens. But it seems that it has come to you, and like now you're impatient. It's touched you, and you're dismayed, right? So that's how it reads to me, anyway.
Yeah, I think that's right. In Job 29, when Job speaks autobiographically, he says basically the same thing. He says, just selected verses here. He says, I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. So he's talking, you know, about the things he used to do in the past that of course, he's not able to do now because he's sitting on an ash heap with oozing sores all over his body. But this is what he used to do. And now it's like, hey, you helped people who were in trouble, and now trouble's come upon you. And this is your response. You know, you're impatient, it touches you, and you're dismayed. And then he has this line in verse 6. Is not your fear of God, your confidence in the integrity of your ways, your hope? We've heard, I think, three times already in chapter 1 that Job feared God. He had this characteristic piety, fear in this holistic sort of way. You fear, you trust, you worship, all this kind of stuff. So shouldn't that be your confidence? And we've also heard about the integrity of Job's ways. You know, shouldn't that be your hope? So that's kind of how he sets up this whole argumentation.
By the way, I would like to point out that perhaps the fear of God is your confidence. Maybe that's not so bad. The integrity of your ways being your hope is probably not a good idea.
Pretty thin ice there.
I don't know. Like, hey, Job, isn't the way you've lived, are you not placing hope in that? Like, God's going to save you. Look at how you lived. Don't love that theologically.
Yeah, and even this opening, the first line of verse 6, if we would just take out fear of, it'd be fine. Is not God your confidence?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that really does kind of fit with these guys too. They're taking a very me-centered, person-centered approach throughout this whole dialogue. So they're turning the sinner back to himself, the sufferer back to himself. So I've set all this up. Verse 7 now. Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed. The roar of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, the teeth of the young lions are broken. The strong lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. You know, by the way, 5 different Hebrew words for lion in those 2 verses. Get the feeling there were a lot of lions in this part of the world. I mean, if you've got 5 names for lions, you're probably dealing with lions on a pretty regular basis. So he starts out, remember, you know, did anybody who was innocent ever perish? You know, were the upright cut off? Well, I can think of an example. I can think of an example of someone who was innocent that perished. I don't know for sure where he's going here because he's setting all this up. But I think what he seems to be communicating so far is he hasn't really addressed Job like face to face yet. But he seems to be saying, listen, or at least leading up to this argument, if trouble shows up in your life, there's probably a reason. And that reason is probably because you've been sowing some stuff you shouldn't sow.
Yeah.
And now you're reaping it. Now this is what a great example of what I was talking about earlier, where you can take something true. In fact, we have this kind of stuff that is elsewhere in the scriptures. You know, you reap what you sow. Is that not biblical?
Right.
Yeah, sure. Biblical. Well, you don't even need the Bible. I mean, we see that in our lives. We see that all over the place. You keep going down that road, you know where it's going to lead. You know, you do this, that is probably going to happen. It's not going to be pleasant. But the error they make is just in applying this to Job's case where it really doesn't fit.
Yeah, I mean, and you have like this, now, you could just be talking practically here. Of course, if you're going to say, remember, who that was innocent ever perished? And you're like, okay, true enough. I guess if you were perfect or innocent, maybe you wouldn't perish. I mean, of course, Jesus was, and he perished. But yeah, sure. But the problem is that like, there aren't any innocent people, and everyone does perish. So I don't know what we're doing here. Like, so, well, go find me someone innocent, and maybe we can monitor him and see what happens to him. But this is not what we're dealing with here. And so, I mean, obviously, you know, before God, no one is good. No, not one. Right? Like nobody's that qualifies. But, and you could do that here, but that's not really what he's getting at. Like, is that you're 1,000% innocent. You've never done anything wrong. What is happening here is exactly what you're saying, which is, hey, man, things don't happen for no reason.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that, and that's the main issue. That's the main theological problem these guys are going to have, is they're working with a very black and white view of suffering, mm-hmm. where if you're suffering, whatever, you know, as terrible the suffering as Job is enduring, or something more minor in your life, well, then you can, if you know yourself well enough, and if you're honest with yourself, you're going to be able to draw a line from your suffering to what you've done that caused it. Yeah. I mean, and this isn't just a kind of a Job's friends issue. We see that in the Gospel of John. You know, who sinned? The blind guy. Who sinned, this man or his parents? Because it can't be, you know, that he just was blind. You know, we got to find out who's to blame for this. Yeah. You know, who exactly sinned that resulted in this guy being blind? Because, you know, there's got to be some like specific wrongdoing that is behind what this person is suffering. That very Pharisaical view of a black and white cause then leads to suffering universe.
Yeah, Job's friends would have made pretty good Pharisees.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely so. Yeah, I mean, this unfortunately, this kind of mentality is not just a like a historical viewpoint. I mean, this the way people still think today, you know? Yeah. You know, somebody sees something terrible happening to somebody else, they're like, man, and I don't really want to say this, but there got to be something happening there. It's going to be like some reason behind why this guy is suffering what he is. So he said all this. Now he's going to get all mystical on us in 12 and following. He's going to talk about this. It's kind of a creepy section, like this. How would you describe it? Like this dream vision, divine visitation that he had. So here's how he sets it up. Now a word was brought to me stealthily. My ear received the whisper of it amid thoughts from the visions of the night when deep sleep falls on men. By the way, that deep sleep word, same word used in Genesis 2 to describe the deep sleep that God put Adam into. So these deep sleep falls on men. Dread came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit, that word spirit can either, it's ruach, so it can be like wind, breath, spirit. So not exactly sure how to translate that, but a ruach glided past my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence, and then I heard a voice. Now, so all this kind of creepy stuff, his hair is standing on end, and he's, you know, it's the middle of the night, and there's like something beside him. Now, all that is leading up to something which I consider to be very anticlimactic, because you're like, man, this is going to be some, like, he's going to drop a truth here that's going to be something nobody's ever heard before. And here's what Eliphaz says he hears. Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? So that's ESV. Could also be translated, this is King James. I prefer this one. Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? Well, that's no. I mean, it just like seems like, really, you set up this whole kind of creepy vision in the night, and that's the truth that you're going to say was communicated to you? Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? Well, no. I mean, doesn't everybody know that? You can't be more just or more pure than God. You don't need some sort of nocturnal, ghost-like epiphany to reveal the truth. Truth like this to you, but no, that's what he says.
What you'd expect to happen here is he's like, all right, there was this stealthy whisper, and it came in the middle of the night and all this kind of stuff, and you're like, okay, and there, behold the vision. You're like, all right, man. And what you'd expect is like, and I saw Satan appear before God and ask if he may tempt you. I got like you almost like, oh man, this dude's setting it up. He's gonna tell him exactly how this thing went down. Like it was creepy, dude. I saw the devil himself, like, and God, like, arguing over whether or not you were as pious as you seem to be. But no, it's just look, man, I don't like, what do you think? What do you think, you're more righteous than God or something? Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's such a weird scene. And you don't know, so that little line there about being more pure or more just, that's verse 17. And you don't know, because we're not told, was that the extent of this supposed revelation, or are the verses that follow it part of what he was told, supposedly told? Or are the verses that follow it, or an application on the part of Eliphaz as to what he supposedly heard? We're not told. But anyway, that's the opening line after he sets up this whole scene. He continues in verse 18. Even in his servants, so his being God, even in God's servants, he puts no trust. And his angels, he charges with something. Now, ESV has charges with error. We don't know what this Hebrew word means, though. It can be error, it could be folly, it could be blame, it could be something else. We just, honestly, nobody knows what the word means, because it only occurs here and you have to guess what it means. But that's one translation: error, folly, blame. So even in his servants puts no trust, and his angels he charges with something, error, blame. He's kind of setting up a contrast here. And the contrast goes on to say, how much more? So if he's even dealing in this way with his, you know, celestial creatures, how much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed like the moth? Between morning and evening, they are beaten to pieces. They perish forever without anyone regarding it. Is not their tent cord plucked up within them? Do they not die, and that without wisdom? I have a negative view of life, but that's what he's setting up here. I think he's trying to get across to Job, listen, nobody's more just or holy than God. Nobody's more pure than God. I mean, and even look at this, you know, even his celestial creatures, he's not like putting his trust in them, and he's charging them with error, if we want to go with that translation. So if that's the way he deals with these highest and most celestial creatures, then how's he going to deal with people who are, as Eliphaz says here, dwell in houses of clay and whose foundation is in the dust? So us, in other words, us dust creatures who have these bodies of clay beaten to pieces every morning and evening. And, you know, it's like we have this cord within us, like a tent cord, like you pull it out and everything collapses. It's kind of the image of our bodies. So he's accenting the fragility of human nature, the lowness of human nature, and that because of who we are, you know, it almost seems like the message is, because of who we are, we have no standing before God. He almost belittles. This isn't low anthropology. This is kind of like belittling humanity, in a sense, the way it comes across to me.
Well, there's this line between having a low anthropology, which you should have, which just means that you don't think more of man than you ought, particularly of yourself than you ought. That you would know that you're a sinner, that you're not God, first and foremost, and is the thing you need to know. You are not God, that there is one, and it's not you. However, this can obviously go in a weird way where you start to forget that you're created in the image of God, and that God, when he created man, said that it was very good. Now, it's not what it once was, but it is still the thing. It is still something that God reckons as valuable. And so the thing that's interesting about this is that he asks this question: look, how much more men who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is death, who are crushed like the moth? You know, between morning and evening, they're beaten to pieces. They perish forever without anyone regarding it. Not true. What is God? If he's not like putting trust and, you know, in his angels, I mean, he's obviously just like not concerned with us at all. I mean, he doesn't he doesn't reckon us at all. In fact, we perish and no one cares. And the truth is, of course, no, God has like a costly plan to go and redeem all these people who dwell in houses of clay and whose foundation is in the dust and this kind of thing. So it's weird. Sometimes you can sort of, you can speak words that make it seem like you have a very high opinion of God without speaking words that show that you have any understanding of what God is actually like. Right. So just sort of having a God that's perfect and big and powerful out there somewhere is not understanding God. You could have as high a view of him as you want, but maybe it's even way too far off.
Yeah, what this guy needs is a heavy dose of Psalm 8, you know, which actually does a good job of balancing this. You know, when I consider the heavens, Psalm 8 says, when I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have made, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? Okay, that sort of sounds like maybe he's going down the Eliphaz theological road. But then he says, yet you have made him higher than, but you have, well, what's the word I'm looking for? That you have made him for a little while lower than the angels and then crown him with glory and majesty. So there you have the full picture. Yeah, I mean, there's a humility that we have before God. And it also an acknowledgement that who we are those created in his image and likeness, who are made to be kings and queens. And all of this, of course, finds its fulfillment in Christ, who even says, you know, not a hair of your head. If he sees even, you know, the birds, sparrows that fall to the earth, then certainly he's going to see you. You know, he knows the hairs of your head, every single thing about you he knows. And because of that, your view of God has to be balanced between kind of this, you know, this great sovereign God, but also this sovereign great God who loves you and knows every single thing about you and cares about you. And you don't have that in what Eliphaz says here.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that when he says, like, all right, there's God, and then there's the angels, and you know the angels are so much better and greater than us. And then there's, you know, us. So like we're way low. It's also just not true. In the hierarchy of creation, mankind is at the very top of the hierarchy of creation. We're above the angels. Angels weren't created in the image of God. God does not send his son to go die so he can redeem a bunch of fallen angels. Like this, none of this stuff happens. And so actually God does esteem man higher than the angels.
They're ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll keep going. That was the end of chapter 4, but we'll just jump right into chapter 5. Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? And this guy is depressing. Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? Implication, no. To which of the holy ones will you turn? Here he seems to be talking about maybe, you know, angelic mediaries, mediators, you know, can you turn to one of them? Can you go to an angel and say, hey, will you be my mediator between me and God? You know, you can turn to one of those. Again, with the implication being no. Surely vexation kills the fool, jealously slaves the simple. I've seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling. His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. There's no one to deliver them. The hungry eat his harvest. He takes it even out of thorns, and the thirsty man and the thirsty pant after his wealth. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. But man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. Now, this is one more of these elements of what he has to say, which can sound biblical, but you have to take it in its overall context. Because, I mean, some of the things he says here, you can see in some of the Psalms, for instance. So in verse 3, he says, I have seen the fool taking root, and suddenly I cursed his dwelling, and then all these bad things started happening. Well, in Psalm 37, you have this. I've seen a wicked, ruthless man spreading himself like a green tree, but he passed away, and behold, he was no more. Though I sought him, he could not be found. So it's the idea that, yeah, you know, you can ask someone who apparently, who seemed to be doing really well, And then all of a sudden his life falls apart because he has not made God his refuge, his foundation, his fortress. And as a result of that, all these bad things start to happen, which is what he's describing here. But you got to look at this in its context. He's talking to Job. And basically the implication of this is, hey, you know, you were firmly established, or at least you seem to be, and now your life is in shambles. Well, there's probably a reason for this. And the reason always goes back to the supposed sin that Job has committed.
Yeah, I mean, even in these verse 6, you know, it says, for affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. The implication is that it comes from somewhere.
Yeah, it's got to come from somewhere. It's got to come from your heart, Job. That's the reason you're going through all of this. I didn't know this until this morning when I was looking at this in the Hebrew. That's a pretty famous verse, verse 7. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. So in the Hebrew, it is literally the sparks is sons of Resheph. So, and Resheph is was like a fairly popular deity in a lot of different cultures of the ancient Near East. So this somehow we end up with this figure of speech. He's god of the underworld too, and pestilence. So sons of Resheph, which is translated almost universally now as sparks, is sort of it's a word picture. It's like these fiery things coming up from this creature connected with mythology. It's a great example of how you can take elements of mythology from the culture and all of a sudden they just become figures of speech. I think that's nothing more than what's going on here with Job. And this is, you know, it's true on the face of things. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. Well, yeah, this is true. I mean, we've all experienced that. But he's applying it to Job, and in that case, he's applying it wrongly. But he's got advice. He's got advice. Verse 8, he's going to tell us what he would do. I always love that. People, especially when you're suffering greatly, hey, I've got an idea. Here's what you should do. This is what I would do.
Have you thought about doing this, maybe?
Yeah. You know, I'm just saying that, you know, if I lost all my possessions and all my kids were killed in the same day and my wife told me to curse God and die and I had boils from head to toe and scraping and I'm sitting on an ash heap. I mean, if I were in that situation, as for me, here's what I would suggest doing.
But I just like that it's this, too. It starts with this. I mean, imagine you're going through all this. So, like, you're a person of faith. You got your friends. You all believe in the same God. So you have all this stuff going on. It's like, hey, have you thought about talking to God about it? Like, what?
No, man. I never crossed my mind. That's what he says. As for me, it's pretty strong in Hebrew. It's a pretty strong adversative, too. Like, but as for me, here's what I would do. I'd seek God. Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know why that never crossed my mind before. I would seek God. And to God would I commit my cause. He does great things. He's unsearchable. And then he goes into this whole wisdom kind of wisdom poem, I guess is what you could say. I'll read through it quickly. Who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth. He sends waters on the field. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness. In the scheme of the wily, schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night. But he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope. And injustice shuts her mouth. I'm sure Job is like listening to this and being like, okay, I mean, that's a very nice little wisdom poem that you have, that you've spewed forth, but it really is meaningless in this context.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because like, this is all nice. I mean, this reads like a psalm. I mean, you could hear David saying something like this, you know, I'm going to seek God and commit my cause to him who does great and unsearchable, marvelous things without number, and then starts going through all the things he does and how, you know, he thwarts enemies' plans and stuff. And that's all great and true for sure. And maybe even would be comforting if you read this, if this was a psalm and you were going through something And it was, and you know, the psalmist was telling you, hey, seek God and commit your cause to him. This is what he's like. Like, okay. The problem is that this is like buried in the middle of a speech that also is like, well, I mean, trouble doesn't come from nowhere. It came from you, I'm pretty sure. I've never seen innocent people suffer this way. But then you like go on this big thing about God, and it's just weird. Like, if this was the only thing that he said, if he said, brother, seek the Lord and commit your cause to him because he does great and marvelous things beyond number, and then he talks about all the good things God does, you'd be like, see, guy seems solid.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. If that's all he said.
But like, you like said so many things that you, it's like one of those things where like this can't even be heard in the midst. It's drowned out by like by all this other stuff that you're saying.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, in the midst of everything he has to say, this is you don't even you like you just skim over it. It's like it just kind of it's true, but it's meaningless.
Yeah,
given the entire context of what he's saying, and then he's not done. He says we can finish the chapter here. He shifts now again to saying something which is true. I mean, this is like Proverbs 3, Hebrews 12 kind of stuff when he's talking about the discipline of the Lord. Behold, look, Job, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Therefore, do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He shatters, but his hands heal. He will deliver you from six troubles. In seven, no evil shall touch you. There's some of that sometimes called a numerical ladder, you know, for three transgressions and for four, you know, these three things and this one thing. We have that all over Psalms and Proverbs. So numerical ladder where you climb from one to the other. He will deliver you from six troubles. In seven, no evil shall touch you. In famine, he will redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the lash of the tongue. You shall not fear destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine, you will laugh. You shall not fear the beast of the earth. Oh, a lot of good stuff. For you shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beast of the field shall be at peace with you. You will know that your tent is at peace. You shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. You'll know also that your offspring shall be many, your descendants as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in a ripe old age, like a sheaf gathered up in its season. Behold, look, Job, this is the closing remark. Look, Job, we have searched this out. It's true. So listen to us and know it's for your good. So he's like he's trying to spin this very positive. Like, listen, Job, blessed is the one that God reproves. Now, we don't know what you've done, but obviously God is disciplining you. So don't despise that. He's going to wound you. He has, but he'll bind up. He's shattered, but his hands will heal, and he's going to deliver you from all these six troubles. And the implication being, if you'll just confess this and repent, then, you know, you're going to live to a ripe old age. You're going to be like that sheaf that's harvested at just the right time. And we know it's true. We have studied this, Job. We've searched it out. So listen, no, it's for your good.
Yeah, dude. Just in case Joe was wondering, God's going to deliver you from troubles. And don't worry. You're not going to fear destruction when it comes. Oh, that's great. Well, I don't know how to tell you this, but it came. And it's horrible, right? Like, I mean, come on, man.
It's like these guys are blind to everything that's happened to Job, and everything's still happening to him. They are they're like some sort of weird detached university professor who's just kind of going to sit here and lecture Job with something which overlooks everything that he's gone through, and then assumes that they know everything about Job, including his supposed sin, and they're going to lay some wisdom on him. I'm surprised a fist fight doesn't break out in the middle of Job. That's the one surprising thing about Job. He never stands up and just like punches one of these guys in the nose.
Yeah. 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 But, he probably doesn't have the energy for that.
That's true.
He's conserving his energy. For his next string of words, which is pretty great. You're gonna hear him gonna say, "All right, that's all fine and dandy, but I feel like me being upset is justified. So you're going to get no sort of audit of my life from me so I can figure out what thing I did that is so much worse than whatever you guys did. And that's why I'm in this situation. I don't think that thing exists. And so we're going to get to hear that from Job next week. But we'll have to wait until then. Chad, I will see you then.
All right. See you then.